This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Mungs. Richard Cordray spent 6 years as the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an office created during the administration of President Barack Obama. Prior to that, he served as Ohio Attorney General and State Treasurer, and in 2018, he was the Democratic nominee for Ohio Governor. Cordray's new book, Watchdog, How Protecting Consumers Can Save Our Families, Our Economy, and Our Democracy, was recently released. And here to talk about that new book is Richard Cordray. Richard, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So before we explore the contents of the book, I want to talk about the current pandemic first by asking how you and your family are doing.
You know, we're fine. I have my wife and I have twins who are in college, and both of them are home finishing up the semesters online, which has been a little bit of a challenge for them, but, you know, something that they have managed. And then my wife is a law professor herself, so she's been teaching online, which has been quite a bit of work to convert her classes online, but, you know, certainly they've been able to continue to function, and I've been doing my my work, which is some speaking and consulting, mostly virtually.
Well, it's tough to have a new book out when you want to probably go on some tours and meet with people and sign some books, but I guess you're adjusting to that as well.
Yes, we got about a third of the way through the book tour, and then everything shut down. So some things have gone on virtually, and some things are being temporarily postponed.
So I want to talk about the current economic situation that the country faces before we dive into the book. Obviously, the current economic situation was brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. But with your experience leading this agency out of the Great Recession, are there certain signs or issues that you're looking for, that we should be looking for, that could leave Americans vulnerable to financial wrongdoing or mistakes, either as individuals or by the government and industry?
Yes, the causes of the current economic problems are very different, of course, but the effects in many respects are the same. When you have a recession and people have lost jobs or they've had their hours slashed and they don't have income coming in, they become vulnerable to scams and frauds. They get behind on rent and mortgage, and they are in danger of losing their housing, which is a huge problem for most households. They also are behind on bills such as auto loans, credit cards, and having difficulty paying those bills, and that leaves them very vulnerable.
And so with those vulnerabilities, what recovery steps do you see on the other side of this current economic situation that maybe we learned from our emergence from the Great Recession a decade ago?
I think we learned one thing. I think we learned that a housing crisis is of a different order of magnitude, because if you end up with lots of foreclosures, the courts are clogged, the housing market doesn't return to equilibrium very fast, housing prices have still not recovered in certain parts of the country, and that is a very different and dangerous problem. And there's been real efforts underway this time to try to minimize foreclosures and ousters from homes. But we're very early in this crisis, and whether that will work or whether it will be overwhelmed by the extent of the distress is yet to be seen.
And so you're talking there about some of the money that was injected into individual households and individual Americans?
Yes, and in the CARES Act, there was a provision that people were entitled to deferring payments on mortgages for about half of the market. Unfortunately, it only covered about half the market, maybe 60% of the market. And a lot of it, people are not entitled to relief, although some of their financial companies are providing it to them. So it's a little bit of a mishmash, but there's certainly been more effort made this time to keep people in their homes, which makes a lot of sense because people who are subject to stay-at-home orders can't stay at home unless they can stay in their homes. And so this is a part of what is being done to address this crisis.
As someone who has worked in a top office within the federal government, and you're seeing some of the funding that's being sent out from federal agencies to the states and to individual Americans and their households, do you think that there's enough done so far, or do you anticipate that more is going to have to be done in order to stave off what you were just referencing, people possibly losing their homes and experiencing similar situations to what they felt a decade ago?
I think you get different points of view on this. I think from the standpoint of the federal government inside the Beltway in Washington, it seems that the relief provided has been massive, and it has been to the tune of several trillion dollars. But it's a poor substitute for a viable working economy, and I think many households are feeling very stretched, and they are not getting enough relief. Also, much of the relief has not been very timely. The small business lending program has not reached many small businesses. People who are entitled to unemployment, in many cases, the systems haven't worked. They've broken down under the volume of claims and have not yet gotten money to people who deserve it. Some of the stimulus checks have not yet arrived. So I think from the standpoint of Washington, it feels that they're doing a lot. From the standpoint of Main Street out in America, not so much. And I think that's going to continue to be something that's going to have to be faced in the months ahead.
What do you think something like this, going through this again, those of us old enough and who have been in a professional workplace long enough to experience two significant economic downturns, what does it do to the psyche of Americans?
I think it makes people feel more fragile, more vulnerable, and more cautious. And I wouldn't be surprised. I think it was true in the financial crisis 12 years ago that consumers came out of it being more cautious about their spending. The savings rate nationally went up and has stayed at much higher levels since before that crisis. Now, you know, we were told and we thought that that financial crisis would be the worst financial catastrophe that we would experience in our lifetimes. And now here we are with a situation that is, if anything, worse and a deeper collapse. Although it may not be as prolonged, that remains to be seen. That's a real question mark right now. But I think it does make people feel very uneasy and, as I say, fragile. And it's going to mean that their spending is going to be something that they're going to be much more careful about for some time to come.
And we're talking with Richard Cordray, well-known in Ohio politics. He also served as the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington, D.C. He's got a new book, Watchdog, How Protecting Consumers Can Save Our Families, Our Economy, and Our Democracy. And Richard, this book is described in promotional materials as telling, quote, a hopeful story, one that explains how our system can be reformed by putting government back on the side of people and to create fairness in a democratic society. I'm wondering, what do you see as the biggest challenge to that vision and that hope?
Well, it's been a challenge under the new administration, the President Trump's administration, because there has not been the same emphasis on protecting the consumer. There hasn't been as much willingness to rebalance the table with the financial companies. So there's certainly been a bit of a retreat from aggressive consumer financial protection. Nonetheless, the agency remains in place. Even its worst and most hostile critics have now acknowledged that it is here to stay, that it's an important part of the government. And why is it important? It's important because it's looking out for all of us. We are all consumers, every one of us, you know, everybody in our families, all of our friends, everybody in every room in America is a consumer and deserves to be treated fairly and with respect and to make sure that they're not cheated and mistreated, which does happen to people. And this new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, was put in place to make sure that consumers had protection and somebody standing on their side looking over the shoulder of these financial companies to hold them accountable.
And I do want to talk a little bit later on about the transition from President Barack Obama to President Trump, something that you witnessed firsthand since you were still in your position as director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. I do want to talk about some other aspects of the book. You talk a lot about student loans. We heard a lot about student loans during the Democratic presidential primary late last year and through the early stages of this year. And we saw one aspect of the current economic mitigation efforts, the relieving of federal student loan interest. So no interest being charged on these loans through the end of September. Your book notes, though, that there are currently 44 million borrowers who carry an average loan balance of $35,000. And you wrote about student loans taking an emotional toll and holding people back. I'm curious what you think should be done long term as it relates to student debt.
Yeah, there are two features of our society that have changed dramatically, I would say, since I graduated from high school and went to college. The first is that the importance of a college degree has become even greater over the last generation or so. You know, the ability to get some further education and advance yourself in the workplace and advance your career prospects is all the more essential now. The second thing is that the cost of higher education has exploded. It has risen by even more than healthcare, which itself has outpaced inflation, and it has priced a lot of middle-class, working-class families out of the market, or has meant that their children can only go to school by piling up significant student loan debt. And these are things that are very different now. When I went off to college, you could pretty much work your way through college if you were diligent and you worked full-time while you went to class, and a lot of people did that. It is really difficult, if not impossible, really, for young people to do that today with the cost of higher education. And yet, as I said, it's more and more important to people's prospects of advancing, and it's a real dilemma for public policy in America that we have not supported our higher education system appropriately, nor have we reined in the cost of that system.
What do you think that these changes, at least in the student loan interest rate right now, what does that do to people's willingness to consider more long-term reforms to this? You saw bipartisan votes on these measures from the federal government that ultimately implemented this. Do you think this will change the narrative at all as this topic is brought up in the future?
It's too early to tell, I think. A crisis does focus people's thinking, and it opens them up to new ideas that they were not receptive to before. And certainly in this crisis, the decision to freeze student loan interest for a temporary period, which is only a temporary period at present, was apparently an easy vote to take in the Congress. Then the question becomes, does that mean that they are now more receptive to broader reforms on a long-term basis? I don't know that we know that yet. And I think that some will be and some won't be, and that will continue to be a fight. I will say that on all sides of the aisle now, people are not seeing much of a solution to the student loan debt problem without some form of student loan debt relief. And I think there's a number of proposals that at first were considered somewhat radical that are now coming more into the mainstream. And I think we'll hear much more about this subject because it is central to the future of America. How do people get further education when it is really needed? And how do we do it on an affordable basis so that our young people, our best young people, aren't saddled with a significant albatross of debt hanging around their neck for, you know, the first decade or two of their adult life.
Your new book, Watchdog, which chronicles your years as the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, features a foreword by Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts Democrat. She was a top-tier candidate in this year's presidential primary before withdrawing. She had a lot to say about student loans, but she was also integral all those years ago in the creation of the CFPB. And she wrote in her foreword in your book, quote, "People needed an agency, a cop on the beat every day, watching what the big banks were up to, writing new rules when needed, and enforcing those rules." So, Richard, your whole book is framed around this battle to create the agency in the early days and to sustain it while it existed, and also what it sought to accomplish and what it did accomplish. Can you explain, though, to the average American how he or she is seeing the impact of having had this agency created?
Sure. And as you say, it was a battle from the very beginning. And from the beginning, Elizabeth Warren led the charge even before she was elected to the Senate from Massachusetts. But the difference this has made for people is when you think about all of us in the consumer marketplace, we all use credit now. It has become pretty much pervasive in our society. Credit cards are a pervasive tool for most people, or debit cards. well, prepaid cards. People typically need to take out a mortgage if they're going to try to buy a home. They often need to take out an auto loan in order to buy a car or truck. And in this part of the country, certainly that's an essential, a lifeline for most households. And so as we're in the consumer marketplace, the question is, are we going to be treated fairly? Who's holding these companies accountable and making sure that they are observing a baseline of decency and fairness in their transactions with us, that they're disclosing to us the different fees that they're planning to charge, that we can understand what the rates are and that we're being offered a fair rate of interest on these loans. And the Consumer Bureau was put in place to do just that. And among the things that we did was we put new rules in place to safeguard the mortgage market so we couldn't have a meltdown of the kind that we suffered 12 years ago in the economy. We recovered $12 billion for 30 million Americans who had been cheated or mistreated in the marketplace. And we gave people a voice by handling their individual complaints about mistreatment and being shortchanged to the tune of 1.3 million complaints in the first 6 years. And that has even grown since then, that people now have a place they can go to get these problems addressed and have some hope that somebody is going to do something to stand on their side and look out for them.
We're talking with Richard Cordray, former Ohio Attorney General and State Treasurer, 2018 Democratic nominee for governor, and was the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. One of the initiatives undertaken by your office, Richard, was Know Before You Owe. This was focused on mortgages, credit cards, student loans, auto loans. Can you tell our listeners about that project and whether you think that was effective?
Yes. This was a pretty basic principle, and it was one that I remember President Obama in particular took note of. He thought that it was just a fundamental principle of fairness that people were entitled to know before they owe. That is, the issues around their loan, the rate of interest, the terms, all should be disclosed to them in a way that they could understand, and so they could make comparisons and make their best judgment about what was the best choice to make for themselves and their families. The other point of that is that it's important to know before you owe, because if you only learn some of these things after you've already entered into a loan, you can end up with a great deal of regret. There were a lot of people who ended up in terrible predatory mortgages 12 years ago before we reformed that market, who had no idea at times exactly what they were getting into, and sometimes it was not fairly disclosed to them. So one of the things we were trying to do was to take these financial contracts, the credit card contracts, mortgage contracts, auto loan contracts, and simplify the disclosure of terms so that people really could grasp what the key points were. It wasn't lost in a forest of fine print, and it wasn't set at a reading level that is, you know, exceeds most people's understanding, a bunch of legalese that nobody can make any sense of. And so that was a project at the Bureau to try to simplify the terms of loans so that people could make comparisons and be in a better position to shop for the best loan for themselves and their family. And I would say we had some real success with it, although it wasn't complete across the different markets because of various different situations and circumstances that we experienced, ranging from the scope of our authority to the complexity of some of the situations in terms of how people get their loans. For example, auto loans, where they deal with an auto dealer and an auto lender, and sometimes that's not very transparent to the consumer.
The new book, Watchdog, documents the fight to create the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It documents a lot of the battles you had to wage while it was in operation. And then towards the end, of course, you explore the shifting political winds in late 2016 and then the inauguration of the new president, Donald Trump. And you write about how you would call into the office each day to find out if you'd been fired yet. You ultimately spent about 11 months as a federal employee in the Trump administration. Can you take us to those days a few years ago and, gosh, what you were thinking about as a federal figure under President Trump and assuming that you wouldn't have your role for much longer?
Yeah, and that was a very live possibility. The Trump administration came in with an intent to deregulate and to roll back regulations. We were an agency that had been put in place to hold companies accountable and to really look over their shoulders and make sure they were doing things right. And there was a tension there, certainly. There were a lot of calls, especially I remember from the Wall Street Journal, to have me fired in the early days of the Trump administration. That was a very immediate threat. And part of it was all designed to try to back us off from doing the job we were doing to look out for consumers. And again, you know, consumers sometimes can be kind of an abstract, clunky term. It really means people and how people are being treated by these big financial companies. And we had a number of significant fights that we took on during the Trump administration to continue to move forward to protect people against the big financial companies. And those fights were made harder by the fact that the Trump administration was out of step with what we understood to be our job.
You just mentioned the Wall Street Journal. They ran a couple of headlines that you note in your book, one of which referred to you as unconstitutional. That was something that you had to battle against the entire time you were in office, was it not? The idea that your office shouldn't exist?
Yeah, the fight against us, which was no doubt originated by the financial companies who felt pressed by our oversight, took many forms. It took the form of congressional efforts to repeal the agency or to rein in our resources or our authorities. It took the form of court fights to try to rein in the agency by trimming our authority or by upending us altogether, the argument that we are unconstitutional. By the way, that issue has now reached, as I prophesied in my book, which I finished the manuscript last October, that issue has now reached the U.S. Supreme Court and is before the court, will be decided this spring. And I think it will result in some changes to the Bureau, but nothing dramatic that upsets the Bureau's ability to carry out its mission of protecting the American public would be my sense of how the case will come out.
What is your assessment of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau now that you're outside of it? We have seen some actions taken during the COVID-19 pandemic against a bank, for example, accused of wrongfully opening up accounts and credit cards and customers' names. Do you think that the agency is still working in the right direction?
I think in some respects it is, and in some respects it isn't. There was certainly going to be a change of direction once I left, and President Trump made appointments to head the Bureau. There was going to be a retreat from aggressive enforcement against financial companies, and there has been. There certainly has been a retreat from enforcing the fair lending laws, which there's not been a single case of those in the 2.5 years. Since I left the Bureau. I can't believe that all discrimination dried up in the marketplace immediately, but that's been the attitude of the new Bureau. And they have sought to roll back an important rule we put in place at the federal level to restrict some of the worst excesses of payday lending, high-cost payday lending. But in some respects, the Bureau continues to function as intended. The complaint handling system continues to deal with, I think, something like 30,000 complaints every month, and gets a lot of relief for people. There's a supervision and oversight program of the financial companies that continues to maintain a regular schedule of oversight to try to make sure they're complying with the law. And from time to time, there are enforcement actions, not nearly as many as we brought, not as consistently as we did. But the state attorneys general around the country continue to press forward on a number of these cases, and there are times when it would be embarrassing for the Bureau not to join them, and so they have at times. But it's a different place, and one of the reasons I wrote this book is as a roadmap to what we were doing under my leadership, why we did it, how we did it, and certainly how things could be done again if there's a change of administration and a change of attitude there.
One part of your book that I found interesting because of its relationship to the current pandemic was a very short section you have towards the end that you just titled The Dynamics of Federalism. And we hear about federalism now probably more than we have since, middle school social studies classes. And I just want to read a quick snippet from it. Quote, there are significant changes that create a novel form of cooperative federalism. They present a far-sighted response to precisely the shifting policy environment we are currently experiencing, where the federal government itself may be disinclined to engage in tough enforcement of federal consumer law because of free market ideology, anti-government bias, desire to support the financial industry, or other reasons. Quote, regardless, the Congress that enacted the Dodd-Frank Act spoke clearly to say it was not willing to put all its enforcement eggs in the federal basket. That was part of a section where you showcase some of the efforts undertaken by states. And I'm wondering if I can ask you, since you're a pretty smart guy, you're a Jeopardy champion and have appeared on the show multiple times, I'm wondering if you can talk about federalism in a broader sense as you see it in relationship to the response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yes, I was speaking there, as you know, of the consumer financial protection itself, where the states have really piled in to maintain some pressure on the financial companies, even as the federal government has retreated. But we've seen the same dynamic very much at work, as you point out, in dealing with the pandemic today. It is governors who have often taken the lead, and in some states, attorneys general, at trying to protect the public, both on the health front and also now increasingly on the economic front. And it is governors who are closer to the public in their states. The federal government often feels very remote from out here in the states. Within the Beltway in Washington, there's a myopic sense the federal government's running everything. I think people at the White House tend to believe that. But out here in the states, we know the federal government is a pretty remote entity, and it's more our state government and local government that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And they have been leading the way in terms of setting the direction and trying to condition the public's response in a way that has kept people safe, but also now trying to manage the economic fallout of that, which is increasingly severe.
The name of the book is Watchdog: How Protecting Consumers Can Save Our Families, Our Economy, and Our Democracy. It's by Richard Cordray, who was the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, well-known in Ohio politics as well, and my guest on today's show. Richard Cordray, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.